Happy Friday. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Today we're talking sports. The Army-Navy game is back at M&T Bank Stadium tomorrow. The midshipmen are trying to make it 15 in a row. And on Monday, the Ravens take on Tom Brady and the New England Patriots. If Joe Flacco and the offense have the kind of day they had last week against Miami, the Ravens could score a big upset. Mark Hyman of George Washington University and John Eisenberg of BaltimoreRavens.com join me to handicap that matchup and for a look at the NFL's aggressive pursuit to get children indoctrinated to the joys of the gridiron early and often. Plus, off-season moves by the Orioles and how the new Major League Baseball collective bargaining agreement might affect the Birds. And J. Wynn Russick speaks with Coleman Domingo, whose new play opens tonight at the Everyman Theater. Midday starts right after the news. And good Friday afternoon, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad that you are with us for this edition of Midday. Coming up later in this hour, theater critic J. Wynn Russick introduces us to Coleman Domingo. He's a really talented guy. He's an actor, director, and a playwright. And his play, called Dot, gets its local premiere tonight at the Everyman Theater. So that's coming up a little later in the broadcast. But first, on this Purple Friday, we're going to talk Ravens football. We're going to talk Army-Navy football with Mark Hyman, who's our resident sports guru, and John Eisenberg, who writes for BaltimoreRavens.com. Mark is on the faculty of George Washington University, where he teaches sports management. He's the author of several books, the latest of which is called Concussions and Our Kids. John is a former sports columnist for the Baltimore Sun and the author of 10-Gallon War, about the early days of the Dallas Cowboys. His next book is due next summer. It's going to be called The Streak, Lou Gehrig, Cal Ripken, and Baseball's Most Historic Record. Gentlemen, always good to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Pleasure, Tom.
Happy to be here.
And you are welcome to join us as well with your questions and your comments on Army-Navy, on the Ravens, on the O's, whatever you feel like talking about sports-wise today here on Midday. Our telephone number, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org. If you want to drop us a tweet, our handle is @MiddayTomHall. So the Army-Navy game tomorrow at M&T Bank Stadium. It's going to be back at Lincoln Financial next year in Philadelphia. I guess it sort of moves back and forth. John, how does that happen? How do they decide where this game gets played? Do you have any idea? I mean, is there some sort of rotation? I mean, it was in New York for a long time, then it's in Philadelphia.
Well, the game has the schools control the game, and I mean their contracts are signed. They do rotate it around. It has historically been in Philadelphia since like the 1920s. Yeah. They've played it in Philadelphia, so it's there most of the time.
Yeah, it's been played over the last 127 years, but they skipped like 10 years. Not 10 years in a row, but they skipped every so often. They would skip games. But it has been played consistently since 1930. One little factoid, Mark Hyman, that I came up with about this is that the very first time instant replay was ever utilized on television was in an Army-Navy game.
Mm, that surprises me.
It's kind of interesting, yeah.
But, you know, the economic benefit from this game is tremendous. So the
community, to the city of Baltimore.
To the city of Baltimore and Philadelphia and wherever it's played. So it's played at the Meadowlands as well. So the city's bid for this. It's bid competitively, and there's a lot of economic activity around the game. So cities really want it.
And it's covered in a way that no other football game is covered, certainly no other college game. I mean, the press that you get about this, I mean, there's a whole week. It's almost kind of like a mini Super Bowl. I mean, there's the dinner on Wednesday night, and the traditions of it are just so great. I mean, at the end of the game, each school sings the other school's alma mater, school song, facing the stands of the opposing team. I think that's beautiful.
Well, they give it, and it's got its own weekend. I mean, they wait until the college football, till the professional college teams are through playing, and then take a little break, and then the real college teams actually have their own weekend. So it's and for years and years, it's a true tradition. People just really get into it. I mean, the ratings are good, and I think it makes people feel good to watch the game.
Yeah.
A little bit better about sports and about, you know, where it's going. And so it's a positive scenario that people enjoy.
Yeah, and it's this wonderful amalgam of patriotism and, national pride, and then you see these young guys who are just so admirable in so many ways. You know, as a musician, I was on the faculty at Goucher College for 1,000 years and had what for many years was the Women's Glee Club of Goucher College. And we would go down to the Naval Academy and sing a concert every spring with the midshipmen, went because they were all male and we were female, so they needed to put the choruses together so that they could come up with a mixed chorus of sopranos, altos, tenors, and basses. So for years, I did this with my friend Barry Talley, who was the conductor of the Naval Academy Glee Club. And just being on that campus, and this was in the 80s and 90s, we would get off the bus, and these young women would get off the bus, and a midshipman would come up and, you know, extend his arm, and they would walk arm in arm to the mess hall, and they were in uniform and stuff like that. And these young men at that time were just the most delightful, intelligent, charismatic, wonderful people. And then, of course, that's continued when they started admitting women. And now it's young men and women are just you know, just beautiful exemplars of what we all want our kids to be. It's really quite something. The Navy has won Mark Hyman 14 years in a row. So let's assume they're favored this weekend as well, huh?
Interesting, because Navy's had a great season. They beat number 6 Houston. The Naval Academy beat the number 6 team in the nation. That's pretty good. And they also beat Notre Dame, which was essentially a road game for Navy. So they've had a great season, but more recently they've had a terrible run of injuries, including two injuries last week on the same play. Two of their star offensive players broke a foot on the same play. Mm. So they're coming into the game at a lot less than full strength. But John, I think they'll be favored anyway, wouldn't you say?
Oh, they're definitely favored. You know, 14 years, that's a long time. I think the people that I know that study this game say, you know, the gap has gotten a little bit closer simply because Army has really been outmanned for a while. They're doing better. They have installed the option offense. Their coach now, they're running the offense that, in my opinion, the service academy should be running. It's an effort offense. You know, it's a classic college football offense.
And what's the alternative to the option?
Alternative would be a passing game, which you see in a lot of college football now. These crazy scores where the final score is 71-62. So they're running an option offense.
And so they're running a lot.
They're running a lot, they're doing better.
Yeah.
And Army's doing better. And so Navy, you know, has been very good this year. They are, as Mark alluded to, they're a little bit beat up. So I don't know. It sounds like Army's closing the gap a little bit, but I don't know whether they can, you know, close it to the point where they can win the game. But I think they're more competitive.
And Army comes into the game with a winning record, which it's had one winning season since 1997.
Yep. They're 6-5, right?
Yeah.
So they're one ahead. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the coach at Navy, Ken Niumatalolo, is a Polynesian guy, terrific coach by all measures. He's been at Navy since 2007. He's the winningest coach in the history of Navy football, and if he wins tomorrow, he will be the winningest coach in the Army-Navy Classic. He will have beaten a guy who last won 8 in a row in the 1940s. So what a big game for him. And I like this guy. He's just, you ever see his press conferences after? He cries all the time. And I'm a crier too, so I'm just big on that. I think this guy is great. But clearly, I mean, running a football program, John, at a service academy is a very different kettle of fish than running it at the University of Michigan or, you know, USC or something, isn't it?
Well, it is a very different kettle of fish, and I think Navy, you have to walk a fine line a little bit. I mean, you know, that calls into question all sorts of things. The athletes you're recruiting, how much time you're giving them when they're on campus to development of their football skills. I mean, these are large questions at a service academy. And so, you know, I think Navy is walking a pretty fine line and has found a way to, you know, get some good football players on campus and to develop them a little more with strength training and things. And I think for the last 10 years compared to maybe, you know, in the 60s and 70s or maybe the 70s and 80s, Navy football is doing better. They're doing better. Mm-hmm. And I think this guy, as a CEO of the Navy football program, is doing a very nice job.
I mean, when you think about the college football teams in Maryland right now, Navy's the best one, right?
I would rank them number one. We will get some calls on that, and I would definitely rank them number one.
I warned you about that. Sean.
With all due respect to the fans of the University of Maryland, I mean, you know, but these guys who are playing for Navy are still doing all the stuff that midshipmen do. They're still bound by the rules and regulations, and you know, great institutional traditions of the U.S. Naval Academy, including the academics, which are very stringent, and as well. I mean, they go through plebe summer like everybody else, and they do that whole thing. You know, it's quite
something. Yeah, I mean, it's a very different population of student-athlete in that, you know, the kids who are going to a top 10 or top 20 university for football, they're anticipating a career in professional football. That's why they're playing college football. And it's very different at a service academy where these kids, they're going to be serving, you know, overseas or in the military in some capacity. So it's a very different mindset.
Roger Staubach, perhaps the most famous NFL player who came out of the Naval Academy, is really kind of an exception to the rule, isn't he?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, how many players, you know, from the service academies are playing in the NFL right now? I'd say it's a very small number.
I mean, in basketball, we had David Robinson, right? But Roger Staubach actually served in the military. Yeah.
He served his full, his five-year commitment. I believe it was 5 years in. It was either four or five. And that actually is something that's just changing recently. You know, they and it's a sore subject among a lot of veterans. You know, the fact that any of these athletes, the Ravens have one right now on their practice squad, Keenan Reynolds, who was the star Navy player for 4 years. And he's been allowed to basically be a professional football player. And there are people in the veteran community who are just can't stand the fact that any sort of deal is being cut. You would get a lot of calls on that.
Interesting. So assuming when his football career ends, he's not going to be that old. Will he then serve his military service? Because the deal that kids cut when they go to the service academies is that they get a free college education, and then they are obliged to serve in the military for a certain number of years. I mean, I wonder, does he then return?
I don't believe that there's a standard set of parameters on this. I believe every case is different. And the Secretary of the Navy makes this call. And, some guys they'll serve in the reserves while they're playing. In other words, they'll find some type of commitment for them to handle. And what happens when they're done, I'm not exactly sure what happens there.
Yeah, interesting. Of course, then the president-elect will be at the game. He'll sit on the Navy side for one half and the Army side for another. At least that's what traditionally presidents and presidents-elects have done. Who knows what this one will do. But, you know, Mark, quantifying the economic benefit to the city of Baltimore, are we better at that now than we used to be? I mean, I remember when the stadiums were being built, you know, people would throw these numbers out. Oh, yeah, it'll, you know, generate X number of hundred millions of dollars in economic activity. And there are a lot of people who thought those numbers were a little fishy. I mean, have, in fact, people gotten better at, you know, being able to apply, you know, a metric that's truthful about the economic impact?
Sports economists are generally very skeptical about the projections that are made when stadia are being built, when a public investment in the stadium is being contemplated. So, but this is different. The stadium is already there. Is the stadium going to be empty that Saturday, or are there going to be 80,000 people?
Completely sold out. Yeah, 70,120 or something. Yeah.
So this
and
is
they're
a going
to go
win.
To restaurants. They're going to stay in the hotels. Yeah. They're going to walk around the Inner Harbor. They're going to take Ubers. They're going to take cabs. They're going to go to bars.
So. Yeah, Baltimore would take this game every year. If Army and Navy wanted to play eight times a year, that would be great for the city of Baltimore. That's very different than whether, you know, there should be public investment in a new stadium. There's a lot of disagreement about whether that there's a payoff.
And there is one of these, you know, pull at the heartstrings stories going on tomorrow afternoon because, as you mentioned, their quarterback got injured and then the second string quarterback got injured. So tomorrow it's the third string quarterback, a guy named Zach Abbey, and he's a graduate of Archbishop Spalding right here in Baltimore. Last December at the Army-Navy game, he was in the stands with the rest of his classmates watching the game. Now he's starting for Navy, going for the 15th consecutive thing. I mean, that first of all, that guy's got to be shaking in his boots. But secondly, you know, and if he isn't,
story,
he's
though.
Nuts.
Yeah.
And but what a great. I mean, it's a great lead to this thing, and that's because this really is about the students. It's about the academies, the service academies. It's not so much about football, but.
Who's writing the screenplay? That's what I want to
yeah,
know.
Yeah, really. I mean, it's just, you know, and Denzel Washington should star. That's my take. All right, we are going to take, speaking of taking, a little break now, and we will be back on Midday with more sports. We'll talk some Ravens. We'll talk some Major League Baseball. They've got a new collective bargaining agreement, or at least an extension of the old one. Talk a little O's, and we'll take your calls and comments. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WIPR. We are glad you're doing that. Stick around. We'll be back in a flash.
You're listening to Midday here on 88.1 WIPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. By the way, coming up a little later today, theater critic J. Wynn Russick brings us a conversation she had with a fascinating guy, the actor, director, and playwright Coleman Domingo. His play, Dot, opens at the Everyman Theater tonight. And coming up Monday, we go across town to Baltimore's other Equity Theater, Center Stage. Kwame Kwe Arma and the dramaturg there, Gavin Witt, join me to talk about what's cooking at Center Stage. That's coming up on Monday here on Midday. And if you're just joining us today, we're talking sports with Mark Hyman of the Sports Management Program at George Washington University and John Eisenberg of BaltimoreRavens.com. You are welcome to join the conversation. Our number 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. So, John, you cover the Ravens. You work for BaltimoreRavens.com. This is the website of the Ravens. So you were a sports columnist for a long time with The Sun. What's your deal as a journalist working? I mean, your checks are cut by the team, right?
Right.
And you publish on their website, which is a very fancy website. Do you ever feel compromised about writing about the team who's paying your way?
I try not to be. I mean, I mean that was the deal that these NFL teams, they all approach their own websites differently. Some of them just put up pictures of cheerleaders and have at it. And then some of them actually, you know, want to draw fans and cover the team. And the Ravens made the decision a long time ago. They wanted to have, you know, strong voices on their website. So they approached me and said, will you write opinion for us? And I said, well, I will. But I asked that very question that you just asked me. And they said, we're fine with whatever you say. We want, I mean, the internet's a democracy. They're looking for eyeballs. You know, and so will you come and do this? And I said, well, we struck a deal, so I've done it, and it's I think over 4 years now, and it's gone pretty well. Last year the team went 5-11. I was not very positive in a lot of what I said, and I never heard a word from anybody. So, you know, I think they're just looking for fair commentary. And yeah. So I will provide that.
Yeah, good for you.
That's and Tom, I would add that this is part of a much broader trend in sports journalism. Major League Baseball has its own website and has hired maybe, I don't know, 50 or more journalists who report on each team and report on the commissioner's office and so forth. So they have their own editorial staff at Major League Baseball. So it's very different than even 20 years ago when most journalists were working in more traditional kinds of settings.
Yeah, I mean BaltimoreRavens.com is competing with The Sun and The Post and Sports Daily and I mean all the publications that cover football, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's an experiment. It's not much of an experiment anymore. I think the reality is it's here to stay. I mean, this situation where the teams and the leagues provide content, and not all of it is flattering. I mean, it's a fine line that they walk. But if they want people to come to their sites, and which if they are able to do that, attract eyeballs, and then you can sell ads. I mean, it's a question of what you're putting up there, and are you putting up something that people want to read?
Why does an NFL football team want people to come to its website? Wouldn't it want them to come to their football games and watch their football games on television? Why do they care about having people come to a website?
Well, number one, if you get enough of them, you can sell ads and make money. and use that to get, you know, sign your reserve tight end or whatever it is that, that you want to do. And I think that they actually see it, the Ravens see it, as value-added for the fans. It's just like, if you're going to be a fan of this team, we're going to give you a website that's interesting, and you can agree or disagree with whatever's on there, but we're going to put it up. And so I think they see it that way.
Yeah. And, Mark, the NFL in general is struggling a little bit this year in terms of eyeballs, at least when it comes to Sunday afternoons and Monday nights and Thursday nights and all the other times. I mean, the ratings have not been stellar.
Ratings are down significantly this year on Monday night, on Sunday night. And it raises some interesting questions about why are fewer fans engaged enough by the NFL to sit in front of their TVs and watch those games. I think it's too soon to say that this is, you know, a downward trend that's going to persist over many years. We really don't know that at this point. But what is it? Is it that the quality of what people are seeing during the games is diminished in some way? Is it that there's just increased competition, entertainment competition, and people are watching other things or doing other things? Is it some of the negative kind of spin that's been coming out of the NFL recently around concussions and repetitive head trauma? We just don't know the answer at this point.
And the Ravens themselves, John, I mean, have the Ravens seen any dent in their box office in terms of people going to the stadium or the particular the radio audience on the Ravens Game Day Network or the television audience?
I believe they have.
They're feeling the hit the way everybody else is?
I believe that's everybody in the NFL is feeling that. Maybe not the Dallas Cowboys when a year when they have 11-1 record or whatever, but just about everybody else, yes. I mean, you know, it's a league-wide issue. And it's something that I think all these teams are very, very concerned about.
All right, we've got a couple of calls I want to take before we talk about the Ravens. Eric in Annapolis, you've got your suggestion as what the best team in the state is. Welcome to Midday.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm a little biased because I played there, but and they don't get a lot of love. But if you're looking at the best team in Maryland competing at their level, the Johns Hopkins Blue Jays are definitely a top.
And you're talking about football.
Johns Hopkins Blue Jays football. The senior class went 4 years without losing a regular season game.
Well, that's a good point. That's a, you know, that's a pretty airtight argument, I think, when it comes to wins and losses. You know, if you win all the time, you got to be considered really good. Well, that's a good when did you play for Hopkins?
I graduated in 2010.
Uh-huh. What was your position?
I was quarterback.
The quarterback. We're talking to the quarterback of the Blue Jays team. Well, I am not worthy. I am not worthy. I am not worthy.
Well, you won't see my name in the record books, that's for sure. But I was definitely there.
And you won every game you played.
No, I wasn't playing a whole lot of games. You know, they had a lot of guys in front of me. But the guys that have been there, this senior class, won 4 conference championships, didn't lose a regular season game. So I just wanted to give them some love. They don't get a whole lot of it.
Well, that's a good point, Eric. I appreciate the call. Thank you very much. Have a great weekend. Mike in Butchers Hill, thanks for calling Midday. You're on with John Eisenberg and Mark Hyman.
Hi, thanks a lot. First of all, I listen to your show every time I can during lunch hour. I lived in Baltimore the last 5 years now. I learned a lot about Baltimore through your show.
I appreciate
so thanks a lot.
Appreciate your tuning in. Thanks.
I was calling because, I know we talked about Navy graduates have played the pros, and I mean, obviously, Roger Staubach is the biggest name, but wasn't there a running back about 10, 15 years ago that was a graduate from Navy? And then you don't hear anything about any Army players that played in NFL. So I just wanted to ask that if you know of any of those, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Mike. So any other Navy players or Army players that have gone to the NFL?
Navy, the running back he was referring to is Napoleon McCallum, who was in the 1980s. And he was a great, great running back. The Oakland Raiders drafted him. And I think the 4th round, and the Navy did not cut him a break in that. I mean, he had to serve in the Navy. So what he did, actually, this is going back many years, the Baltimore Sun sent me out there to write about him. They stationed him in Long Beach, California, and he would work his Navy job from like 5 in the morning to 2 in the afternoon. And then he would drive to, it was the Los Angeles Raiders then, he would drive up to the Raiders practice with the team, and play. And so he was working both jobs. He was a young man and working both jobs. God bless
him. He's in the Sun today. There's a wonderful interview with him, with his recollections of his years playing in the Army-Navy game. There's a really good piece in the sports section of the Sun. I recommend it. Well, that's incredible to think you could be in the Navy and in a professional
Well, then he got hurt. He got hurt and he came back and played, and the situation changed a little bit. And I don't know of any Army players that have played in a long time.
Any come to mind, Mark?
No.
I can't think of any. Yeah. No. So let's talk a little bit about the Ravens' chances on Monday night. They're playing Monday Night Football in Foxborough against Tom Brady and the New England Patriots. The Baltimore Sun today, for example, has 7 people in their sports department making predictions about the game. None of them have predicted that the Ravens will win. John, you wrote a piece that says that, you know, the 4 or 5 things that the Ravens need to do to pull it out. So give us a little coaching.
Well, it's a tall order. I mean, it's very, very tough. I've seen a statistic where the Patriots have not lost a home game on Monday Night Football since 2005. So there you go. It's going to be very difficult up there. They're very good. Tom Brady, since he's come back from his suspension this year, I believe he's thrown 19 touchdowns and 1 interception. So he's 39 years old. He's at the really still in total command of his talents and doing very well. So it's going to be very tough for the Ravens up there. But the Ravens historically have gone up there and played well. The year they won the Super Bowl, they won the AFC Championship game up there.
They've had some good nights.
Joe Flacco, I mean, the team has changed since then, but they have a quarterback who's gone up there and succeeded, is very confident, no doubt, going in there and thinking he can win. That's half the battle. So, they played a great game against Miami last week. They need to be able to, their pass defense is going to have to slow Brady down a little bit, and the offense is going to have to show some measure of what they saw, what they did against Miami. And that's your A game. And if they bring that, I think they do have a chance in this game for sure. It's not a totally dominant Patriots team, so I think an even game could unfold.
I mean, Mark, watching the game last Sunday, it was kind of like the invasion of the body snatchers. Like, you know, who is inhabiting Joe Flacco and the offense?
And John is the expert on this topic, and we've been talking. I mean, what do you take away from the offensive performance last week? I mean, it was so much different. They seem so energized. The balance and the rhythm of the offense seem so much improved over what we'd seen earlier in the season. How do you account for that, and what does that mean going forward?
Well, I think what we saw last Sunday, not going to see so much going forward in terms of just that was all passing. That was just total passing. They just threw out the Dolphins just gave him the middle of the field, so they just threw all day long, and the Dolphins never adjusted. It was pretty simple, actually. But I think going forward and historically, this Ravens offense, you have to have somewhat of a run-pass balance, and I think you'll see that Monday.
Because the running game is important, because if the team just figures you're passing all the time, they'll just defend that way, right? You've got to at least scare them into thinking that you might actually run through the middle of the field.
And otherwise,
and if they don't defend it, then you can get 15 yards on those kinds of plays.
That's exactly right. What they call play action, which is a fake to the running back. You know, most plays begin with a fake to the running back. Well, if you never run it, then they don't buy those fakes, and they just sit back and pass defense. So without a doubt, you have to be able to do both. And I think you'll see that going forward.
Dean Pease is a guy who's the defensive coordinator. The Ravens have the best defense against the run in the country right now, right?
Yes.
So does that matter against Tom Brady? Because he runs it like once every 4 games, right?
It doesn't matter against Tom Brady at all. He doesn't run at all. They do have a running back, LeGarrette Blount, that's almost got 1,000 yards this year. So they have run the ball successfully. I don't think they're going to run it at all on Monday night. I think they're going to line up and try to beat the Ravens in the air.
And will the Ravens do the same thing, just try to beat the Patriots in the air?
I don't think so. I think that they're going to try to have more of a run-pass balance.
So they'll balance it, yeah.
Yeah, the longer, if you can run the ball with any success, what do? You keep Brady off the field.
Yeah.
So
just hold on to the ball, chew up the clock. Right. So, Mark, do you buy this thing about Monday night being somehow some extra special, light the birthday candles kind of event? I mean, people talk about, and I'm not saying you shouldn't buy it, because it seems like the whole world does buy it, that, it's like you mentioned that, Patriots haven't lost on Monday night for 11 years, So what makes Monday night so different than Sunday afternoon or Thursday night?
Well, I think going back to the origins of Monday Night Football, it was very different. I remember I think I was 4 or 5 at the time, watching the first Monday Night Football game in 1970. I believe it was the Jets and the Cleveland Browns, and Homer Jones caught the winning touchdown pass in that game. And it
very
was,
precocious 4-year-old.
Maybe I was a little older than that. And it was an it was a spectacle. It was so much more than a football game back in those days. And even the broadcasters became
Don Meredith.
Yeah, I mean, they became, you know, like cultural icons. Cosell and Don Meredith, and I think Keith Jackson was in the booth at the beginning. And for many years, it persisted as this game that was, you know, beyond sport. It was not just a game and an audience of sports fans. It was people who were really plugged into the kind of cultural, you know, vibe of what was happening.
But how does that affect players in a game? I mean, I totally agree with you. I mean, there is this whole cultural thing of Monday Night Football. It's a whole different thing. You know, now NBC, their ad campaign is Sunday night is football night, you know. Does it matter? I mean, people talk about, you know, playing in front of a national audience. Well, now isn't there a national audience for every game? I mean, fantasy football is designed to get you to be interested not just in your home team's games, but all the games of everybody else who you've invested in.
I think it does matter. I think it matters to the players to know that everybody, their peers, are sitting at home watching them. I think that's really
because it's the only game that night.
It's the only game.
Yeah, on Sunday afternoon, you're competing against a bunch of other games. Yeah,
right. I think it does matter to them, and it's more like a theatrical production. You know, the lights come on, and you know they just feel more inspired.
But I tell you what has changed. Back in the 70s, this was the only game that was played outside. Well, virtually the only game that was played outside of this Sunday afternoon window, Monday Night Football. Now you've got games on Thursday night, you've got games on Sunday night. And the NFL, I mean, not surprisingly, is looking for ways to slice up, you know, its TV content and generate revenue.
And you can find a college game at 10 o'clock Tuesday morning.
I think that's a very big difference. It's not that singular national game that it was in years past.
So we're running out of time, but I do want to touch on the fact that the NFL is making a very aggressive move towards getting children interested in professional football or football in general. This is a different kind of approach, isn't it, Mark, than they've had in the past?
There's a story in the last week on Huffington Post by a great sports writer named George Dorman that I really recommend to everybody listening.
And we'll post
program.
It on our website.
Yeah, it's just a fantastic story explaining the efforts, the marketing efforts of the NFL to reach small children. I mean, and we're talking about cartoons and websites that are that target kids. And the NFL's interest is in engaging young kids, not only in becoming football players. They want kids playing football because, as the piece describes, the more engaged kids are at playing football, the more likely they are to become consumers of football as kids and then into adulthood.
And fewer kids are playing football because of the sports, because of the injuries that people are associating with the game. You've got people like the President of the United States, LeBron James, Brett Favre, saying if, you know, my sons would not play, I wouldn't let my kids play football if I had sons.
And of course, there's nothing wrong with marketing your product, but what makes this so interesting and in some ways troubling is that there are great concerns about the risks to children playing football, not only from concussions, but from repetitive head trauma. Blows that don't rise to the level of a concussion, but you know, if you hit your head 1,000 times during a football season, what is the cumulative effect of that over many years? For kids who start playing football as early as 5 or 6, that's where the tension is. What is the NFL's responsibility to recognize that we don't know as much as we need to know about the risks to kids?
What do you hear in the locker room about this, John? I mean, here you have these Ravens players largely in their 20s, early 30s. I mean, are they talking about it? Are they worried about it?
It comes up. You know, I mean, you have to ask. And it is fascinating, honestly, to talk to them because they're in the lab. They're the ones. Everyone, and we're all talking about it. They're living it. And you don't, as you can expect, you don't just get one answer. I mean, some people don't care. Some people are worried. some people, it doesn't affect how they play, or they would be out of the league. But there is concern, and you know, it's I think in my two cents, it's the greatest concern in and around the NFL. Forget the TV ratings; is they have to figure out how they can make the sport safer.
By the way, Joe from Middletown writes in that Alejandro Villanueva played for the Pittsburgh Steelers. He's a West Point grad of 2010, and he did two tours in Afghanistan.
Right. That's correct.
Which is terrific. Bob Anderson was born on the 31st of March, 1938, and he played halfback for Army and was drafted by the NFL. So good for him. And that is all the time we have, as it turns out. So we have like 10 more seconds to tell us what's going on with the Orioles. Everybody else seems to be buying players left and right. The Orioles aren't buying any. Should we give up now, Mark?
Yeah, I think they ought to petition to move to the AL Central Division. That's my solution.
Just change leagues. Huh?
Yeah, I mean, just get away from the Yankees and the Red Sox.
And the Red Sox, who are buying up players like crazy. All right, good to see you guys. Thanks so much for coming. Happy holidays. Mark Hyman is on the faculty of George Washington University, where he teaches sports management. He's the author of several books, the latest of which is called Concussions in Our Kids. John Eisenberg writes for BaltimoreRavens.com. He's a former sports columnist for the Baltimore Sun and the author of 10 Gallon War, about the early days of the Dallas Cowboys. His new book, scheduled for release next summer, is about Cal Ripken's record-setting consecutive game streak. It's going to be called The Streak, Lou Gehrig, Cal Ripken, and baseball's most historic record. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. There's more coming up. Stick around.